Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is 2014's Rubber Soul, a low-budget recreation of two interviews that John Lennon and Yoko Ono gave 10 years apart. Using just two locations and a grand total of four actors, filmmaker John Lefkowitz cuts between the 1970 Rolling Stone interview, conducted shortly after the Beatles' breakup, and the 1980 Playboy interview, conducted 3 months before John's death, all faithfully recreated word for word with very few additional bells and whistles. The film was nominated for the Audience Awards at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and was awarded the Founders Prize by Michael Moore at the Traverse City Film Festival. Despite both of those successes, the film is currently free to watch on YouTube, if you just go in and search for Rubber Soul Film. So Ed, the film is about two interviews with John, 10 years apart, but what is it really about?
Well, it's about all of us in a way, isn't it?
Yes.
So I suppose what it's doing is it is showing you how much a person can change in 10 years, and it's also showing you how subjective the interview experience is, and perhaps that the interview, particularly the rock star interview, is a slightly imperfect tool for the telling of an artist's story. Certainly, that maybe it should be afforded less significance. So certainly the Rolling Stone interview is afforded a huge amount of significance. And it really informed a lot of people's opinions of the Beatles in general. It definitely informed people's opinions of John Lennon right up until for a good, 25, 30 years or so. And actually, I think there's a pretty good chance that he was in a certain mood that day. I think it's a pretty good chance if you'd done the same interview the next day, he might have said completely different things.
Yeah, I love that. I saw... I think there was a review on Letterboxd or IMDb or something where someone said that the whole point of this film is to show that the interview answers that he gives 10 years later are so different. But honestly, if the interview was taking place 10 minutes after, it would have been the same experience.
Yeah, exactly.
He was just that kind of guy. We've spoken about this a lot, haven't we, about how he was just sort of succumbed to his own sort of wants and moods as it was in that case. And I think this film really sort of shows up the contradictory nature of what he expresses in these interviews.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, 1970, he's sort of fresh out of Primal Scream therapy with Arthur Yanov. He's still very raw. He says something in the interview along the lines of, like, you know, I haven't had the chance to put myself back together again yet, or something like that. So, you know, he is not in a place where it's a good idea to take what he says as gospel. But then there's an argument with John that there was never a time to take what he said as gospel. And actually, maybe that applies to all of us in some way, you know. And so, you know, it made me think a bit about things like Wikipedia pages, which I think are sort of have become a wonderful sort of free crowdsourced source of truth in a way that, and through the sort of consensus approach to fact correction, if you like, whereby it's being seen by enough eyes and therefore gets reviewed enough times that it eventually becomes pretty reliable and pretty source, pretty close to the truth. That actually, especially with artists, a lot of status is accorded things they said about their art, and that sort of passes into canon or consensus, you know, and people think, oh, this is what he thought about his art, you know. And John, you know, says things, but one of the things about his tone of voice and his manner in the interview is that he is like slightly frustrated at times, you know. It reminded me a bit of, you know, when kids first go to school and they suddenly have the ability not to tell you everything, because like they have some information that you don't know and they can hold it back from you.
Yeah.
You say, well, what did you do at school? Nothing. You know?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
it will.
Yeah. And he is he seems to be in that mood a bit. You know, he sort of asks questions like, what do you make of the rock and roll scene? And he kind of says that, I don't know, like, you know, tell me some specific songs and I'll tell you if I like them. Like, he's a bit weary with the whole thing, you know.
I kind of get the impression as well that it's frustrating, I think, to watch this film in some ways, because he's so contradictory with what he says himself within the same interview, even.
Yeah.
And I think that he strikes me sometimes, and I can't stress enough that these are interviews that are recreated word for word, inflection for inflection.
Yeah,
So this is not an interpretation of what he said. This is, you know, this is a recreation.
Yeah.
So I think we are able to talk about John Lennon in this way through the lens of this film.
Yeah.
But I think he strikes me as someone who's, you know, we know he's a big thinker. But actually, he comes across in his interviews as someone who hasn't necessarily conditioned his thoughts or organized his thoughts in a way that makes what he wants to say about a certain subject particularly coherent.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's why he ends up contradicting himself, because I think he probably, you know, as a big thinker, I think he often is thinking quite holistically about certain things and, you know, asking about rock and roll music, and rather than just go down the route of giving it a double thumbs up and saying, yeah, it's gear, man, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's actually thinking, well, actually there's a big question to ask me, because I can immediately think of contradictions and what I want to say about that, and then that then brings out a side of him where he's almost frustrated by the question because it's too big to answer. And he almost approaches a lot of questions that way, where he's sort of put out at being asked by them because he doesn't find them easy to answer, and he wants to say big important things, and he often does, but they're not always consistent.
It's a frustrating thing to be asked like a very general question, and you think, no, but I need you to frame it in some. So I can remember years ago, like, having a meeting at work where I and like another guy, like, there were three of us, and the one guy who had called the meeting said he wanted to talk to us about like a specific thing. And then it was his meeting, he was chairing it, and he started the meeting by saying, so what does everyone think? And we were like, but you asked us here, like, ask us questions, you know. But and I think John is thinking the same way. It's like, no, can you frame it for me, because it's just too big.
Yes,
because otherwise, all I will do is just ramble on. Otherwise,
but also it shouldn't be. Or I don't know whether it's because of how we know press interviews to go more now, 50 years later. But we think we kind of expect celebrities now to be interviewed and for them to be playing the game. Sorry, I mean, when they're being asked questions. So, you know, they know they're there to provide soundbites and to sell the thing they want to sell.
Yeah,
and to, you know, there's nothing more expected of them in that way. So being asked, do you like rock and roll music, shouldn't have to have a big answer to it that solves the question of whether or not rock and roll music should be liked.
I suppose it does show that he is really sincerely engaging with the questions.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess that's my point, is that he's almost too involved in the in the interview process, when really, like, any other person would be sitting back and being like, yeah, of course, rock and roll's great. Like, you know, and also, you know, my album features a lot of it. You should probably all go and buy it, you know?
And sort of, you know, like Paul as an interviewee, you know, we've talked a lot about how he has specific anecdotes, you know, yesterday and scrambled eggs, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, George with playing raunchy on the top deck of the bus, all that kind of stuff. You know, the good stories, I like hearing them. But, like, he is a guy who is interviewed a lot and will just... unless the interviewer asks him some interesting questions, he reacts well to that these days. I've seen some interviewers recently do that really well. But there were years when people didn't, and he would just reel off the same anecdotes because why not, you know?
Yeah, of
but
course,
John never really had that, I don't think, or he never had that instinct.
No, there's instinct, but there's also, I think, decades of training.
Yeah.
You know, like through overtime and experience to know that actually what gets a good reaction, what gets good press, you know, those things, those stories, like you say, like the only he doesn't reel them out because it's the only things he remembers. He reels them out because they tend to always hit the mark.
Yeah.
And he probably was allowed to for a long time when asked the question to steer the answer down one of those paths, one of those well-trodden paths, because he knows he can then go on autopilot almost. And
yeah, definitely. Know, here are the points I want to make. It's a bit like job interviews, right? You go for a job interview and you've got like the sort of five examples of the good stuff you've done before, and you want to work them in. And basically, whatever the question is you're asked, you will bring it round to you putting in, including those examples.
Good team player.
Yeah, exactly.
John Lennon would be a terrible job interviewee, right?
yeah. But actually, I think but one of the reasons for that is I think that...
What are your strengths? I don't know. Give me some examples and I'll tell you if I like them.
Yeah. It's like, well, you know, you've got to be a bastard to make it. Okay, yeah, we'll give you a call. But like, I think one of the reasons for that is that Paul actually has a desire to please the interviewer to some degree, but the public, certainly. He has a desire to sort of please the public and sort of give them what they want and put on a bit of a show in a way, which is not an instinct that John had, really, I don't think.
No, but I will say that... So I think one of the key differences between the two interviews, with John Lennon being in a very different place in his life at both of those times, is the 1980 interview, you see a much sort of more laid back, almost like a bit of a more mature version of Lennon.
Mm.
But in the 1970 interview, he's sort of in rant mode. Like you said, he's in a mood.
Yes.
And it feels like he's got much more of an agenda in that interview. And I think what comes across in his answers, and obviously, you know, in the film, but I think again we can assume that it's faithful to how Lennon was in the actual interview. One of the things that comes across is there is almost a bit of a show that he's putting on. He's being deliberately provocative in some of the answers he gives. There was a moment that really stuck out for me when he mentions that, I think he says something like, which was the album that Klaus Voormann did the artwork for?
Yeah.
And he says, oh, it's Revolver. And it's like, okay, and did that come out after Rubber Soul or before? And he's just like, do you really not know which one?
Mm.
Can you tell me of that white album with the drawing by Klaus Voormann on it?
There's an album.
Revolver?
Was that before Rubber Soul or after?
After.
Oh, I see. Rubber Soul came after.
You really don't remember which?
No. Maybe the others do. I don't remember those kind of things because it doesn't mean anything.
Without wanting to sound too cynical, I watched that and be like, is that him wanting to come across like he doesn't care?
Definitely, yeah.
Right? Yeah. So in that way, it's a bit of an act that he's putting on, definitely, in some ways, because that makes him seem like he's above it all.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is important, I think, for him at the time to seem that way.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and actually there's a sort of interesting comparison because like in Anthology, sort of, 25 years later or so, George can't remember the order in which Rubber Soul and Revolver came out, I think. And that is totally sincere, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, A, because much more time has passed.
Yeah,
and B, because I think George genuinely did disassociate from the Beatles thing.
Yes. Yeah.
And you know, thought of it as like nice memories, but not the most important part of his life in the end.
Yes, you know? No, I completely agree. Yeah, that makes sense. So going back to the sort of the original question I asked at the top of this about what the film is really doing, there's obviously an exploration there, I think, around the kind of contradictory person that John is and was known to be. The film even starts, I think, with a quote saying, "I change daily." What does that say?
"I change daily, you know."
Is that what it's...
Yes. Crucially,
you know. Yeah. And you know what I do. But yeah, so and I think there is that element to it, which you're showing John as being a contradictory person by nature. But also, I think it's quite interesting to me to see that actually a lot of the interview questions he's asked are in 10 years apart are the same questions. You know, he's being asked about how him and Yoko got together. He's been asked about the Beatles and the Beatles breakup.
Yeah.
That you know, doesn't really put the sort of the whole press and media industry in a good light, I think.
No, true. I mean, you've done far more like interviews with actors and directors and whatnot than I have.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
Is that your experience of it? Because you would have done roundtables and also you would have done a fair bit of it yourself in realizing that you're probably asking them a question that they've been asked a lot.
My experience, and I say this all the time and try and make this point as much as possible, but the normal roundtable or the normal press junket or interview experience is that you are told that that person you're interviewing is there to sell a thing.
Yeah.
There is normally the implication that you shouldn't stray too far from the subject of that thing.
Yeah.
And then there is almost always a ridiculous time limit on the interview.
Yeah.
So I think... The best example I can give is I once interviewed Ryan Gosling. I was in a hotel room alone with Ryan Gosling to interview him for his latest film.
Yeah.
I was told that he will only answer questions about that film, and I only had 6 minutes. Right?
Okay.
So I had 6 minutes to interview him about this film. And I just remember coming away thinking, well, by the time you go in there and you establish, you know, the normal questions that you normally ask, which is, you know, how you got involved in the film and, you know, what interests you about it and those things. You're not left with really any time left to explore anything original.
Mm.
So Ryan Gosling's experience of that day is 30 odd journalists literally asking him the same questions in 6 minute intervals.
Yeah.
And no one wins. Like he spends the day bored. All the journalists don't get really anything of interest or value. And then there isn't anything that then gets published that really helps to sell the film because there isn't anything interesting for anyone to watch or hear.
Yeah,
that celebrity say. But this is going back a few years, and I think now in the last couple of years, there's been a lot more focus on not asking celebrities about the thing they want to sell and getting them to do a fun thing instead that is likely to go viral.
Right. Yeah.
So like funnily enough, even earlier today, so we're recording this maybe a month after the Barbie film has come out. So I saw a Ryan Gosling video today of an interview situation. And that situation was him being tested on which he preferred between a stack of pancakes and a Greg sausage roll. Right? And that was the whole video.
Yeah.
So the film that I interviewed him for, this is probably going back like 8 years ago, not really anything particularly of interesting or value there. But we've gone the other way now, where what does get seen and gets a lot of eyeballs is Ryan Gosling eating a Greg sausage roll for 3 minutes. And at the end, it just flashes up Barbie now in cinemas, you know, and that's going to get more attention. And now the interview and press junket scene tends to be more geared towards producing that kind of content rather than sort of focusing on exploring the film in a sort of more, I guess, I don't know, intellectual way.
Yeah, I suppose so.
You know?
Yeah. You just reminded me, actually, that you and I both interviewed Bryan Cranston on the same day.
Yes, we did.
In the same press junket. So it was
Breaking Bad, right?
Yeah, it was a Breaking Bad DVD release. And I was in it was a round table. I was in at about 10 a.m. and he was absolutely lovely and brilliant and just great company and like really enjoyed the experience. And you could see that he was doing that thing of like, he had his stock answers and would direct the question towards that, but great. And then I think you interviewed him about 5 p.m. when he was a bit tired and a bit jet lagged and like a little bit more crotchety, I think.
Well, you know, but that's interesting. I wouldn't have said he was, I think you can tell when it's been a long day for celebrities, particularly when the day is involving that. I remember him being absolutely lovely, but he was a little bit more commanding of the room than I think your experience was. Right. So when I think of the interview that I did with him, and you know, both of us went, our interviews would have been with three or four other journalists in the room at the same time. I always think of that time where I was interviewing him, where he would quite often, when he was telling an anecdote, quite drop his voice down quite low and quite quietly. Mm. And then you kind of, journalists have to sort of lean in, and, you know, it's almost like you could hear a pin drop because you're sort of on the edge of your seat, like listening to him tell the story. And it's quite a compelling trick. I've done a few interviews where celebrities have that trick in their toolbox a little bit, where they talk quite slowly and deliberately, but it's almost powerful in a way. But it would be less enthusiasm than what you probably saw being with him early in the day.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
But he was still lovely. He's all like, you know, he asked everyone's names and shook everyone's hands and took photos and all that stuff, which most people don't do in those interview situations. Yeah, right? He was lovely and doing all that stuff. But yeah, he was a little bit more subdued, I think, rather than grumpy.
We should make a film in which we do shot by shot reconstructions of the two interviews we did with Bryan Cranston in order to juxtapose the changes he went through over the intervening 5 hours.
Such a contradictory man. So mercurial. So anyway, getting back to John Lennon.
Oh yeah, the Beatles. Sure.
And this film, I found it quite funny that 10 years apart, two different journalists for two different publications. Mm. Essentially, one of the things that this film, whether deliberately or not, it highlights the fact that actually the whole interview scenario is quite staid and repetitive, and it reminds me of that fact. And then it gives me sympathy for the interviewee. You know, these are interviews 10 years apart, but ultimately questions that would have dogged John Lennon throughout that time as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it kind of illustrates, I don't know about a difference in interviewing styles. Jan Wenner, who's doing the Rolling Stone interview in 1970, seems slightly cowed by the experience. He's quite reverential. He asks questions like, you know, when did you first hear the phrase Lennon is God or something like that? Mm. And which I wasn't aware that people ever said, you know, but John is, you know, sort of, I don't know, maybe psychedelic era or something like that. He says something along those lines. David Sheff in 1980 is a bit more probing in general and does ask him some awkward questions, especially about his wealth and stuff like that, which like Jan Wenner is not doing anything that is going to piss John off.
Yeah.
You know, because he wants him on the side. Like so it's worth saying like how much Rolling Stone magazine, of which Jan Wenner was the founder or co-founder, like in its infancy, its association with John Lennon was like very key to its early success.
Right.
And then being able to get sort of exclusives with Lennon was really, really good for them, you know. Yeah. So like it made sense for them to be like Team Lennon.
Yeah, sure.
At the time. You know?
But, and I guess it's also indicative of Lennon's status at those times as well. You know, like 10 years after the Beatles are broken up and after 5 years of Lennon not really being on the scene, I guess you can imagine a journalist being a little bit emboldened by that and feeling more comfortable with being a little bit more probing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, this guy isn't, you know, like, there are bigger stars than this guy now.
Yes, exactly.
I'm not interviewing the biggest star in the world. I'm actually, you know, maybe even David Sheff isn't quite aware what he's getting into when he goes to the Dakota. Is he thinking, am I actually going to be interviewing this sort of weird hermit? I'm not sure. Maybe it's that, you know, because he will have heard stories about, oh, he's just a house husband now and he's baking bread and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe he didn't know what to expect.
The wealth question is really interesting. That was one of the bits in this film that really stood out for me, because I actually wasn't aware. I mean, we'll probably get on to just exactly how iconic these interviews are in terms of what we learn from John Lennon, what we understand about the Beatles from these. So I know a lot of the content from these interviews just from what I've read previously, but I actually wasn't aware that he'd been probed about that. And so being asked specifically, you know, you're singing about giving up all your possessions, but you are worth $150 million. Like, is it right that you have that much money?
Yeah.
And it's a really awkward question for John. I mean, and John doesn't, I don't think, he doesn't come off badly in answering it. I don't think he has a convincing answer.
No, he doesn't engage with it. It's a bit of a sort of politician's answer where he sort of answers, deliberately or not, answers a slightly different question to the one that was asked or frames it differently.
So he says something along the lines of, when you're talking about giving up possessions, possessions can also mean like possessions in the mind, you know, like your unnecessary obsessiveness with things that don't matter and, you know, pervasiveness and of thoughts in your head and stuff, which isn't really what the question's asking.
No.
The question's asking is, do you need $150 million in your bank account right now?
And he says, well, what would you have me do? Like give away all my money and walk the streets? And it's like, no, that's not what I asked you.
No,
like, I'm suggesting that you can just still be rich, but just be less rich and be fine.
Because he literally says like $150 million, isn't $100 million enough, or $15 million, or $1 million? Which is a really good question to ask when you've become particularly famous for a song that suggests decrying all of that.
Why does anyone need $150 million? Couldn't you be perfectly content with $100 million or $1 million?
What would you suggest I do? Give everything away and walk the streets? I wasn't content with no dollars. I wasn't content with $1 million. And I'm not content with $100 million. Contentment doesn't lie in money.
Mm.
Then why be in the game of getting more?
Because to do what I do, I need what money does.
$150 million?
It's all relative, isn't it?
What about all the talk about transcending possessions?
You can transcend possessions without walking around in a robe. And possessions can be in the mind.
And I found it really interesting because we did a whole episode on the Mark Chapman film, didn't we? The Jared Leto one.
Chapter 27,
yeah, thank you. And that was one of the first times that I understood that one of Chapman's motivations for killing John was that he felt aggrieved that Lennon was singing about giving away possessions in Imagine, but was actually... He felt that John was being hypocritical by sort of, you know, being a rich, famous guy.
Mm.
That was one of the first times I realised that that was one of the motivations that Chapman had.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that that had actually been addressed with John directly 3 months before that murder took place in this interview, you know?
Yeah. I do think John's sort of privilege is privilege is a bit of a loaded term to use because you know it's not like he grew up with lots of privilege, but he did grow up with more than the other Beatles. But I'm more talking about the financial status he's got to, and he lives like quite a secluded life. He and Yoko are like really fabulously rich by this point. Like they have invested money like very, very wisely in real estate. They've bought a herd of cows that turn out to be like an incredibly lucrative investment for them.
Magic cows.
Yes, right, exactly. Yes. I forget what it was, like a slightly rare breed that I can't remember.
He traded in for beans.
Yeah, he met a strange and wizened old man in Greenwich Village. No, I'm not sure what it was. No, anyway, like I will. I'll figure out the exact details and put a link in the episode description. They bought cows and they were very rich at this point. There are things John says in it. So there's one where they're talking about drugs. So they're kind of juxtaposing what he says about drugs in 1970 with what he says about drugs in 1980. And it actually is quite revealing about the sort of life he was living in 1980. So in 1970, he's saying, he's more or less claiming an addiction to pills. He says, well, you know, I've been, we started smoking pot in 64 or so, but I was taking pills every day from Hamburg up until then. You know, I was basically addicted to them.
Yeah.
And then in 1980, he says, well, you know, if someone gives me a joint, I might smoke it, but generally I don't. And he says in 1980, like, why is everyone on drugs? Is everything so bad? He's been happily snug in an expensive apartment, you know, sort of costed against the outside world. But it is worth noting that this period from sort of mid-70s onwards is famously a real decline for New York City in terms of the economy of the place. Like it had a sort of economic crash, which I think was associated with sort of middle class people moving out to the suburbs, and just a real nosedive in tax income. Like, city like had to declare itself bankrupt at some time. This is the period when it's sort of nicknamed Fear City because of the crime, and there are policemen at the airport giving out pamphlets,
right,
saying welcome to Fear City, like, here's how to keep yourself safe, don't go out after 6 p.m. make sure that if you the hotel you stay in, make sure you're near a fire escape, all this kind of stuff, don't go on the subway under any circumstances, you know.
Yeah.
And it's quite a dangerous place to be. He and Yoko are completely insulated against that. And it's sort of interesting that he liked New York City, the cultural center it was, but I think more liked the idea of it rather than actually engaging in it. You know,
yeah, sure.
The punk scene has been going on around them in New York City. He's not really engaged in it particularly, you know.
I actually find it really interesting that, you know, you mentioned there about the punk scene. Just interesting hearing John Lennon mentioned by name, Sid Vicious.
Yeah, it's
like,
funny,
which I just hadn't really heard him do before. Even don't think about them being sort of happening at the same time, which is ridiculous.
No, well, no, of course, but I know exactly what you mean, because, you know, I do end up thinking, like, I remember there was some interview he gave, maybe it was even this one, I forget, but he sort of mentions, like, Madness. He's heard Madness, and he likes, he's heard, like, One Step Beyond or something, or one of the early ones, because Madness have just started. And he's like, oh, yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's funny. Like, they kind of intersected for, like, a few months when they got going, and then John Lennon knew of them, and then he died. But you think of them as being completely separate periods in a weird way, you know?
Yeah. No, that was, and that's one of the great things, I think, about these, this setup where it's a, as much as possible, a recreation of the full interview, is that you get all of this additional information which probably wouldn't have made the cut when these interviews got published.
Yeah.
You know, like, just a sort of an offhand comment about Sid Vicious and stuff. It's great just even, you know, that, seeing that play out.
Yeah.
Talking of playing out, what do we think of Joseph Behra, who's the main actor playing John?
I think he does a great job. Like, with the brief that he has obviously been given, he does a really great job. Now, so you tend to watch these on a couple of levels. The first one, which is kind of inescapable, is that your first reaction is like, whether you want it or not, is this a good John Lennon impersonation? The answer is, in terms of the accent, no, not quite. But in terms of the cadence, and actually that's the interesting thing about his performance, because he has obviously been given the brief of, You want to recreate the cadence of the way he speaks.
Yeah.
That's what you're going for. And he really, really does that well. Like, I mean, it's
incredible. Like, yeah. It's just, like, to the extent that there are several times at the start of the film where I was like, have they just dubbed the original recording over him? Because it's, because I think you're right. I think the accent isn't quite nailed on.
Yeah.
And understandably, for a production like this, he's a few steps removed from being a good sort of John lookalike.
Yeah.
You know, so you're kind of taken out of that immediately because of that situation. But because he nails the cadence and the intonation so well, you are forgiven for thinking that this is John Lennon speaking.
Yeah.
Like, it's so, such a great mimicking of John Lennon's general, like, demeanor as he speaks. Yeah. Demeanor is not the right word. I guess it's, you know, it's like the attitude he has as he's speaking.
Mm.
And it feels completely spot on.
And one of my big things is I wish I was a fucking fisherman. I know it sounds silly and I'd sooner be rich than poor and all the rest of that shit, but the pain, you know, I wish I'd sooner not be. Ignorance is bliss or something. If you don't know, man, there's no pain. Oh, probably there is, but that's how I express it. It's shit.
You know, one of my big things is I wish I was a fucking fisherman. I know it sounds silly, and I'd sooner be rich than poor and all the rest of that shit. But the pain, I'd sooner not be. I wish I was ignorance is bliss or something. You know, if you don't know, man, there's no pain. Oh, but probably there is. But that's how, you know, that's how I express it. It's shit.
We've come up against this a few times now, I feel like, and I think we were talking in our episode about the Hours and Times.
Mm.
If you remember, like, we'd listened to the DVD commentary where the two actors were talking about it.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. And they were talking about how they approached their performances as but almost trying deliberately not to do a spot-on impersonation because they felt like it wouldn't leave room for character.
Mm.
The interesting thing about this is that it's not leaving room for characterization deliberately. Like, it is trying to recreate the thing exactly.
Yes, that is the point of the thing.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's they're not trying to create any kind of character outside of what exists on the tape already.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, he sort of does get John's character across quite well, I think, in general. He certainly gets his frustration across, his indignation in the Rolling Stone interview. And, you know, I remember, you know, the other thing I've said about Ian Hart before is that, you know, that it gets the sort of acerbic side of John very well. Joseph Behra actually gets John's sort of slightly sort of giggly side across very well in both interviews, actually. There's a sort of nervous laugh that he does sometimes when saying things that's very Lennon. And actually, I don't think I've really heard other Lennon actors do that before.
In those days?
Yeah.
I mean, why didn't anybody ever say, how come those guys don't split up? I mean, what's going on backstage? I mean, what is that Paul and John business? Why aren't, you know, how can they be together so long? Yeah. Well, we spent more time together than John and Yoko in the early days, the four of us sleeping in the same room, practically the same bed, in the same truck. All right, doing everything together. Nobody said a damn thing about being under the spell. They tried. Maybe they said we were under the spell of Brian Epstein or George Martin or something. There's always somebody has to be doing something to you.
Yeah.
We are the ones that cast the spell, not us.
Guys are all right, come on.
Oh, yeah, all the boys is all right, but you go with a woman, there's something abnormal.
A twist.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a twist and a half, isn't it?
I find it really interesting that, you know, when we talk about the audio of those interviews, those original interviews being recreated so completely, it's not just word for word, like it's not just quote for quote, it is all the times that he stumbles on his words or changes sentences halfway through a thought, you know, like all the things that happen naturally in speech are clear and present in this film. It's actually unusual to watch a film that isn't a documentary where the dialogue you're watching is actually told in that way.
Yeah.
Because everything's always polished, obviously, because that's how films work.
Sure.
So to go to the length of not just remembering the key thrust of what John is saying, but to actually recreate the audio syllable for syllable, it reminds me of I used to do English language for A-level, and I used to study the International Phonetic Alphabet, where you had to, you know, transcribe someone's speech, but actually put in things like a symbol for a glottal stop. And there was like different symbols and like pairing of letters and stuff for the sounds rather than how words are spelt. And it reminds me of that because it's the difference between how people actually speak naturally and how an actor reciting a line from a script sounds.
Yeah.
Because it's completely different.
Yeah.
So I was just really impressed that in some ways I was, you know, it takes me out of the film a little bit because I'm like, oh, this is so unusual to be watching a film that is doing this kind of thing. But it's actually a very impressive feat for the actor, Joseph Behra, to be doing that so faithfully.
We had to do something. And what do you do when the pill doesn't wear off and it's time to go? You just can't. I used to be up all night with Derek, whether there was anybody there or not. I just could never sleep.
We had to do something. And what do you do? The pill doesn't wear off when it's time to go. You just go. I used to be up all night with Derek, whether there was anybody there or not. You know, I just could never sleep.
So, you know, I think one of the things that Beatles fans get frustrated about with Beatles biopics of any kind, or when the Beatles are being played by actors, is this idea that it's not being faithful enough to what happened in real life, which is a fair complaint, and I understand it. You know, I think we've come up against this enough times now that I think, generally speaking, we've come to the conclusion that it's good when a bit of room is left in the story for there to be some expression within it, you know, while sticking broadly to the facts. Certainly The Hours and Times did that in quite a different way. But the interesting thing about this is that it is attempting to be like absolutely faithful to what happened. That's the point of it. And I don't know, but then of course it raises the question, well, why not just use the original footage then?
Why that's just... what I was going to say. That's what those same fans would say, right?
Well, yeah, like, yeah.
You know, this is a work of fiction based on the Beatles' lives, but that's rubbish because it's just not as good as Beatles' lives. Yeah. And then when you have a faithful recreation of something, it's like, well, why even bother? It's like, well, then you can't win.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because, you know, this, you know, for those people, but I mean, by the way, as I say, I think it's a reasonable position to want these things to be more true to life because the story itself is so dear to you. I completely understand that motivation. But on that basis, like, this should be your favourite Beatles film ever.
Yeah.
Right? You know.
Yeah. but actually, it raises a good point, though, because you're right. We can listen to the original audio instead of watching this film.
Mm.
So again, I guess there is a question there of what is this film really bringing to the table, if that's the case?
Yeah.
Because if it's not a degree of artistic license or storytelling, what is the film actually offering?
it's a fair question. I'm not sure I've got a clear answer to that. I mean, so I certainly enjoyed it. I thought what it was doing was very interesting and was very well realised. It's worth as a sort of artistic experiment. It's sort of more than its entertainment. Actually, I found it entertaining. I don't think that's fair to say. Like, I was definitely engaged by it the whole time. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not one of those ones. I'm not quite sure how to judge it. Really,
I think it kind of reminded me a little bit of I want to say 98. I could be wrong on the year. When Gus Van Sant remade Psycho. And he did it like it was
an
artistic experiment to recreate, you know, this film like shot for shot.
Yeah,
I think there's value in that if you're looking at it through the eyes of an experiment. Like, yeah. Is this a thing that can be done? And then you're raising questions. I think, you know, the point of that as a piece of art rather than as a mainstream film to watch and enjoy is when is something truly original? When it's, you know, it can sort of raise these questions about the nature of the art itself and the medium itself. And
yeah.
I think there's something adjacent to that in this film, which is as an experiment for recreating something so faithfully, you know, it raises these questions around what counts as an original versus a retelling.
Yeah.
If it's, you know, one is identical to the other. And I guess, you know, if you're going to be really generous, the question between comparing a recreation versus the original is not unlike the question the film itself presents where you're comparing the 1980 interview to the 1970 interview.
Yeah.
You know, the difference, the nuance in the differences of the answers that John gives between those two interviews are as much up for the debate as the one that we're having right now about whether something recreated faithfully is worth as much as just listen to the original.
Yeah, yeah.
Have I gone too far down like a bit of a pretentious rabbit hole there?
Oh, I mean, it wouldn't be the first time. But I think that ship sailed long ago.
Yeah, that's fair.
But no, I mean, that example about Psycho is interesting because, like, I suppose what Gus Van Sant is doing there is kind of asking the question, is the thing the sum of its parts?
Yeah.
Psycho is a classic and is acknowledged to be a classic by everyone. If I do the exact same things that created Psycho, will my film also be a classic? So the answer is like no. I mean, because no one thinks the Gus Van Sant version is a classic. But I've never seen it actually. But like I don't think people generally think it's bad. But it's not really there to be judged good or bad, and that's kind of the point.
Yes,
he's saying like, oh, I've made the same thing as Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I don't think he's saying, like, why aren't I as lauded as Alfred Hitchcock? But he is kind of posing that broad question.
And
there's a similar thing, I think, going on with this, because it made me think a bit about how I've never listened like all the way through to the Rolling Stone interview properly, but I did after watching this film. And it sort of made me realise how there are so many quotes from John, which I've heard. There's a lot of it, actually, his voiceover in the anthology comes from this. So, you know, sort of different quotes, which I hadn't realized the source, you know, because anthology is sort of, his audio is pulled from a few different sources, sort of longish interviews he did. And I'm so familiar with those quotes, like the cadence of things. So, I mean, there is one that I don't think is in this film, but is in the interview, the original interview, when he talks about how the dentist spiked him and George with LSD.
Right.
And he says, and he just put it in our coffee or something, you know.
A dentist in London laid it on George, me and our wives without telling us at a dinner party at his house. He was a friend of George's and our dentist at the time. And he just put it in our coffee or something, you know.
So, and that it is that... My brain is so familiar with the way that he said that.
Yeah.
Spending a bit of time thinking about the word coffee or something, you know. Like,
yeah.
The Beatles' music is sort of quite similar to me as well, in that I'm so familiar not just with the songs, but with the little ad-libs. You know, I know I can listen to the fade-out of Hey Jude, and I know exactly when all of Paul's ad-libs are coming up.
Yeah, sure.
Even though I've been listening to the same thing repeated over and over again for the last 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
I know when he's, you know, about to do, you know, a big whoop or something like that, because it's just completely ingrained. And so what that is the sort of specific vagaries of performance, things that were done completely off the cuff and have just, because of their iconic status, have stayed in people's consciousness and is just there on the surface the whole time. And I suppose what a film like this is doing is sort of taking these and asking, well, is there the actual event where he spoke these words, is it meaningful in and of itself?
Yeah,
or
sure.
if you recreate it, is it equally meaningful? It's not 100% posing that question, but that's the kind of area that it's getting into, I suppose.
I'm also a big believer in if these are the questions that we are asking and watching it, it doesn't matter if that's the filmmaker's intent or not. Like, you know, that's true of the film itself.
Yeah.
So basically you can get away with doing anything.
Do you think he's listening to this and go, yeah, all right, lads.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I just thought it'd be a laugh, to be honest.
Well, it's that question, isn't it? Like, you know, when you studied Shakespeare at school and like the teacher tells you, like, well, actually, you know, this exact usage of this verb here suggests this that happens later on, and you'd be sitting at school being like, I bet Shakespeare wasn't thinking that when he wrote it.
Yeah, rubbish.
Yeah, exactly. You're making this like, up, miss.
Yeah, this rhymes, I'll stick it in.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. moving on from Joseph Bearer, we should probably talk about Yoko's role in this film.
Yeah.
Which is mainly one of silence.
Yeah.
Which again is faithful to original recordings. It's interesting, isn't it, like how this presents that, because she has a few moments where she interjects the occasional word.
Yeah.
There's one moment where she starts to follow up on a point that John's made, and John very quickly shoots her down. The only time that she's doing this, yeah. And he's like, well, no, I want to stay on what we were just talking about there, and just talks over her stuff like that. And we talked before about seeing documentary footage of John and Yoko on chat shows, where it feels like John's quite often talking over Yoko or not giving her a chance to speak and stuff. And this feels in a similar vein.
Yeah, I think that was in the US versus John Lennon.
That's right, yeah.
Yes, you're right. So I think in the original Rolling Stone interview, she certainly says more than she does in the bits of it that we get in this film. But it's still, she is very much the sort of junior partner in the conversation, if you like. But she isn't silent, you know. But so Denise Lee, who plays her, it's fair to say she doesn't have a lot to do, but she does a good job with what she has. And also there's quite a lot of, like, she will just sort of like half, as people do naturally in conversation, just sort of like half repeat something her partner has just said. I think he's sort of talking about Marxism or something. And she kind of says, yeah, Marxism, yeah. Or, you know, that kind of thing in the background, which she did in real life, and Denise Lee faithfully recreates the exact thing.
I've heard the Beatles playing avant-garde music when nobody was looking for years, you know. But they're artists, and all artists have fucking big egos, whether they like to admit it or not.
I've heard the Beatles playing avant-garde music when nobody's looking for years, you know. But they're artists, and all artists have fucking big egos, whether they like to admit it or not.
Which, that... In fact, I can imagine might have been quite an interesting challenge for her, because you know, that thing when you're acting, I'm sure like the best actors don't do this, but amateur actors are mainly just kind of waiting for their chance to speak.
Yeah,
they're not really thinking about the thing that the other person is saying and engaging with it as you might if you're trying to immerse yourself into a character. They're actually like, okay, as soon as they say bread rolls, then I say, like, that's my cue to say, you know, like,
yeah.
It must have been quite hard for her to escape that, because she has, you know, sort of minutes and minutes of silence.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, as soon as he says, got to be a bastard to make it, then I say, yes, John, or whatever. Like,
yeah,
then,
exactly.
Then that's
yeah.
me for 10 minutes.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
It must be hard to escape that, you know.
Then I can just relax again for the next 10 minutes.
Yeah, after. Yeah. Yeah, just like, have a cigarette in the background.
You make it seem like a play as well, you know, yeah. in that respect. Like, you know, her the idea of her sitting around for 10 minutes as if this wasn't done over a series of takes. You know, just literally like, and if she got the timing wrong, they'd have to start again.
The whole thing again. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I will say I was quite impressed by, so John Lebkowitz, who's the director here and the editor here actually, I think does a brilliant job in both roles. I was quite impressed to see this, you know, this is a film that's essentially about two big conversations that happen, both conversations between three people that happen in two very minimal locations.
Yeah.
But the film is, we haven't really mentioned this, but the film is split up in chapters, right? You have these interstitials that,
yes.
That sort of set out what the next chapter of conversation is going to be about.
Mm.
And it happens quite frequently throughout the film. But I feel like each chapter is shot slightly differently. There are slightly different camera angles that are used for both interviews for each new chapter.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't necessarily pick up on it, but it's just enough to keep it visually interesting throughout the film. Because this is 83 minutes, I think, if the camera angles were the same all the way through, which you'd be forgiven for thinking someone might do, they weren't really thinking about it. But
yeah.
there are moments in the film where John is talking about particular subjects and the camera's actually really quite up close in his face.
Yeah.
Or there are some bits where you're just sort of slightly off at an angle. And yeah, it's just a neat trick to just subconsciously almost keep the film from getting too stagnant.
Yeah, definitely. I think those things are really important. And actually, it's not the kind of thing that I always pick up on. I think you pick up on these things more than I do, but I certainly would have noticed if it was more static than it was. I would have been aware that I was sort of growing visually bored with it in some way, but perhaps not being able to articulate why, that kind of thing. But yeah, I think they're just really good creative choices that he makes, you know, because I suppose, you know, there are these things where you think about films that are sort of all shot in one location or all shot in one take, which there's been a few of that in the last sort of 10 years or so. You know, think about films with only one actor on screen. So say like Lock with Tom Hardy or the one where Ryan Reynolds is buried alive. Is it called?
It's called Buried.
It's called Buried. It's a clever title. The sort of ones that have been shot all in one take, that kind of thing. So like you do have to do things in those to keep the audience sort of visually interested as much as anything else. Like Locke is very good at it because there's always a phone call going on. And actually the phone calls tend to be people whose voices you recognize. So there is a bit of interest for you in that, where you're kind of going, is that Olivia? Yeah, it's Olivia Colman. Yeah. that's kind of in there as well, whether that's a deliberate creative choice or not. But anyway, yeah, I mean, films like that present a creative challenge. Yeah, and I think he's met it really well here.
There is a film I'm thinking of, and I can't for the life of me remember what it's called, but it's a horror film that was famously at the time filmed all in one take.
Yeah,
I remember watching that film and coming out and feeling like that entire movie was sold on the gimmick of it being all shot in one take, or on the idea that it's all one take.
Yeah.
And it was horrible to watch,
right?
Because you're very aware that there were no cuts, and actually, you don't think going in that's going to, you know, it's going to be an interesting thing to experience visually. But you don't actually realise that there's a reason why you cut, like, and actually following the same camera, not the same camera angle because the camera moves, but the same camera viewpoint for 90 minutes, however long, is actually quite a tiring thing to do.
It is, yeah. There's actually the series The Bear that's on Disney Plus at the moment. Yeah. There is an episode, actually, I'm not 100% sure if the entire thing is one take.
There's an episode in season one, if that's what you're talking about, because I haven't seen season two yet.
Yeah, it must be.
Which does that, but it's for the first, I want to say, 10, 15 minutes of the episode up until a big thing happens. And then that's when the first cut happens.
Yeah, you're right. That's it, you know. And like that is a show that I find it quite stressful watching that show in general, because there's just so much stuff happening and everyone's shouting at each other. And like sometimes I do have to sort of pause it for a minute and go and have a walk around and then come back to it. But yeah, like these things all have a thing to hang their hat on. You know, for the bear, that the way it really ratchets up that tension is kind of its like gimmick, for want of a better word.
Yeah. One of the other things that the sort of the multiple camera angles technique adopts. I say it's a technique, like it's an innovative thing to do. Obviously, it's you know, if you're a filmmaker, it's an obvious thing to do. But yeah. As a viewer, I find it interesting that that is a concession that a filmmaker has to make when you're looking at action that doesn't move on screen. But I think what it does do is that you've got a camera that is very subtly shifting to different angles, and I think that also, in a way, almost subconsciously mirrors John's own sort of shifting answers, and his, you know, when he's talking and he's giving opinions about certain things that are contradictory in nature, this idea of us watching him through a series of different angles kind of adds to the effect that actually, you know, he himself is kind of maneuvering around certain topics in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and sometimes he's even just sort of framed right in the corner of the shot. You know, there's one I'm thinking of in the 1980 scenes, where, because there's a picture behind him on their kitchen wall, and he's sort of framed, you can see most of it in this shot because he's really only in the corner of the shot himself. I forget what he's saying at the time, you know, but that's obviously what it's doing.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So what it's doing with the two things being 10 years apart made me think about how we think, like decades are very sort of neat things in a way, you know, in the way that you think of the 60s as, you know, a cultural movement, but a block of time in which these things happened and everything changed. And then 1st of January 1970, the things that happened in the 70s started happening.
Yes, of course.
Everyone just stopped wearing the clothes they wore on 31st of December 1969 and just immediately started wearing leather jackets, you know, and doing heroin rather than LSD straight away, you know, that's kind of how you think about it. So in terms of like cultural appreciation or cultural study, if you like, decades tend to be like quite easy shorthands for sort of, oh, this happened in this period and this happened in this period. And actually there's very neat bookmarking. The Beatles' career and like their solo careers are so, and John and Paul's in particular are sort of very neatly bookmarked in that way, that the trilogy of solo albums that Paul has done, McCartney from 1970, McCartney 2 1980, McCartney 3 2020, they're all like very neatly on a zero year, you know. And you know, and the interesting thing about McCartney 1 and McCartney 2, you kind of think of those as sort of markers of where that person is, and these interviews for John are also markers of where he is.
They're the same markers, really. It's in the same time.
They're the same years, yeah. So both 1970 and 1980.
Yeah.
And one of the things about the Rolling Stone interview in particular is it is probably the thing that's most responsible for kicking off this idea that Lennon was the great genius and Paul, everything Paul did was a bit throwaway, which sort of persisted for far too long. Jan Wenner was very sort of enthusiastically participating in this idea. Like I said, it worked out well for Rolling Stone magazine, absolutely. But actually, it's interesting that with this idea that sort of John is the authentic one, that these 1970 and 1980 interviews are being taken as the sort of the key texts. And actually Paul's equivalent of that almost is these two albums he's done. So he's almost ironically, Lennon's supposedly the artist, but yeah. Paul is the one who's expressing this stuff through his art, if you like. John is the one who is expressing himself through the interviews. Yeah, because there aren't really iconic Paul McCartney interviews, if you like.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
You know,
yeah.
There are ones that you see them a lot on YouTube, you know, because you will see ones sometimes where Paul is obviously a bit irked. There was a Give My Regards to Broad Street one where he interviewed on BBC News show by Peter Sissons, maybe, and he's quite annoyed, you know, that kind
yeah.
of
thing.
How much money do you stand to lose if it fails?
Nothing.
Why is that?
Well, because it's 20th Century Fox's film, and already it's not actually losing money. I say, what happens is with me, as you probably know, being in the media, is that if I do attract some bad reviews, those are the ones that are shown. And you'll notice those are the only ones you showed, and your man there, who was doing the criticism, was all he mentioned. In actual fact, there is another side to it, and they're people, and they are going to see it, not in huge droves. But as you probably know also, this isn't a massive budget film. The man's talking like $9 million is a huge budget. It's actually a very small budget. So for what it costs to make, it's actually doing quite well.
But like these aren't, there are no quotes from that that have sort of passed into law same way that John's did.
Not representing just himself as a solo artist. I think, you know, when I think of iconic Paul interviews, if there are such a thing, it's when he talks about doing drugs for the first time.
Oh, of course, in his back garden. Yeah,
there's
yeah.
that one. Right, and then maybe not many more after that. I can't think of any others you know, where he's given a quote that's sort of stuck around his whole life. Yeah, where there's plenty of John ones.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, but, you know, there's two readings of this potentially. One is that Paul has not generally said things in interviews that are significant enough for people to have really stayed with people and for them to be sort of, you know, endlessly quotable.
Mm.
Or everyone thought he was a bit of a lightweight, and so even if he did say those things in interviews, they didn't really take a lot of notice. You know, there will be so many. I feel like from 1970 onwards, basically I don't think John did loads and loads of interviews, but basically all the interviews he did for the rest of his life are now very well known. And and so, I mean, by the way, like these two interviews we're talking about now have been published in their entirety as books. So Jan Wenner published the Rolling Stone interview as Lennon Remembers, and David Sheff published the 1980 interview as a book called All We Are Saying. As an aside, by the way, about David Sheff, I don't know, I recently watched a film which was on BBC iPlayer called Beautiful Boy, and I was sort of watching it thinking, or maybe we can get an episode out of this, you know, as I generally will. It is about, so David Sheff is played by Steve Carell in it, and it is about his real life struggle with his son's drug addiction. Son is played by Timothy Chalamet.
Yes, I know the film you mean. Yes, yeah.
And it's a really lovely film.
Of course, I completely know the film you mean. I didn't realise that was David Sheff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Wow. Yeah, yeah. If you remember, like in his office, he's got these sort of John and Yoko.
I haven't seen the film. I just know the one that you.
Oh, right, okay.
I know the one you're talking about. Yeah, because that's very, very recent.
Yeah, fairly recent. Yeah, yeah. Because Timothy Chalamet has not been around for that long, I don't think.
Probably longer than we feel like he has, but yes.
Very true. Yeah, he's probably got grandchildren now, you know, and we just haven't noticed. You know.
But no, I remember that film coming out. It was a real sort of, you know, Oscar buzz around it, awards buzz the film. But yeah, I mean, it's remarkable to me that it's the guy who interviewed Lennon in 1980. I didn't realise that at all.
So yeah, like these interviews are really accorded a significance. You know, no one has ever published an interview with Paul McCartney in a book. I suppose his lyrics book is not far off that, I suppose.
Yeah,
but it's not a direct transcript. There is something quite reverential about publishing the exact transcript of an interview, as opposed to a summary of it or an article that talks around it in some way, even in long form. You know, it's like, well, this is these guys' words. Actually, like David Sheff's title that he gave the book, All We Are Saying, obviously is, you know, from Give Peace a Chance. But him choosing that does seem to be a statement of, you know, this was John's statement to the world.
Yes.
Like,
you know. Yes,
so it just seems that, like, you know, when John said things, people thought this is important, like, you know,
yeah,
in some way. And it may have just been that journalists were very ready to feed that part of him. I don't mean to feed his ego particularly, but I think maybe the beginnings of that habit of just sort of media sort of eating itself, feeding itself and eating itself,
yeah, sure,
in a way, you know, like, and like, here's this guy, he always gives us good quotes, we give him good publicity, and so it goes round and round and yeah, round, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But and also just on a very basic level, you know, what I thought you were going to say there, but the beginnings of something was the beginnings of having just someone who is really, really good at giving sound bites.
Yeah.
Because just seemed to have this refusal to play the game that we were talking about earlier, you know.
Yeah.
Quite happy to contradict himself,
yeah,
and quite happy to just say whatever is interesting in the moment, which is a journalist's dream if you want people to buy your publication.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it made me think as well about, you know, that thing about sort of highlighting contrast between him and Paul is that, so what, one of the things that really characterizes the Rolling Stone interview is like just how disobliging he is, not just about the other Beatles, but about all the people around the Beatles, you know. So he says, describes sort of Derek Taylor and Neil Aspinall as sort of like egomaniacs and sort of something along the lines of, oh, that, you know, they were in the court of the kings for this, you know, and they thought they were the big shots. They thought they were the artists because they hung around with the artists for so long. And sort of, I'm going to say, like a year earlier, you know, Derek Taylor is like, you know, he's in the lyrics of Give Peace a Chance. He's there's a quote from him on the back of the Live Peace in Toronto album. You know, Derek Taylor is like a figure, like they all loved Derek Taylor.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, John is just kind of lashing out at anyone and anything connected with the Beatles. There's a very interesting thing where he recounts his taking acid accidentally, which is kind of fairly well-known anecdote about when he, I think he had like a sporran that he like kept various pills in around 1967, which he would just in the habit of just sort of opening it up and seeing what he fancied and just taking one out and eating it like a sweet. And he, in the studio in March 1967, he takes what he thinks is an upper. They're at a session for Lovely Rita or Getting Better or both, I think. And it turns out to be LSD. And so he's taken LSD by accident.
Mm.
Paul kind of recounts this as being, so like George Martin says, oh, you okay, John, you're looking a bit peaky, you know, let's go and get some air. And they go up to the roof.
Yeah.
And so Paul recounts this as like, when we realized, we were like, no, and like ran up to the roof to get him just in case he thought he could fly and jumped off because George Martin didn't know what he was doing. And John, I don't know whether he remembers it differently, but basically what he doesn't mention in this interview is that Paul's reaction to like John being like, he was having a bad trip and Paul took him back to his house in St. John's Wood and took acid himself so he could be in the trip with his friends,
right,
and help him through it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was, I have heard it said that this was Paul, who was like famously reluctant to take LSD. This was his first trip and he did it. I don't think that was true. I think he had done it before.
Right.
But that's an incredibly nice thing for a friend to do for another friend.
Yeah.
And John recounts this anecdote in 1970 and completely leaves out that part of it.
Sure.
Like he's absolutely, he is like slaying every sacred cow going.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why he's there. But to the point where he must be, you know, he's quite bitter about Paul in the thing. And, you know, there may be a lot of things where he has reason to be bitter about Paul. You know, they've just gone through the Alan Klein thing and they're all, you know, they're all arguing. Like, you know, Paul was certainly pretty stubborn in those, like, probably not very easy to deal with in all those negotiations. But he is being, you know, we have said that maybe he's being a bit disingenuous by like pretending that he, you know, that he's forgotten things that he probably hasn't forgotten and things like that. And here he's actually just being disobliging. That approach to just, you know, saying a specific story in which your friend did a nice thing, but leaving out the bit where the friend did a nice thing because it suits your agenda at the moment. And ultimately, a lot of this film is about the agendas he had
Yeah.
And the difference in those agendas, you know, from 1970 to 1980, I suppose.
Or... And that gets called out quite explicitly in the film as well. Like, I'm thinking of the moment where you see in the 1970 interview, John dispel like claims that he and Paul wrote many songs together.
Mm.
And then in the 1980 interview, like that actually gets put to him. And he was like, oh, yeah, no, I was lying. He just basically says, I was lying.
Yeah.
You know, he said, oh, we wrote together all the time. Like, and he reels off, like, you know, we wrote this and we wrote that on the van on the way to Newcastle and the other one as well. So, like, you have this situation where you have one half of the film calling out the other half for being just made up, you know, or, you know, untrustworthy as a source.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, it's almost a sort of like, you know, deliberately unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, which then, you know, the same relator later on calls out his own unreliability, you know, which is a really interesting kind of construct, actually. You know?
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that actually made me pick my ears up, because there's a moment in this film where John mentions something, and I didn't realize it came from this interview, and it's when he's talking about a writer, I think it was William Mann,
right,
who described the Beatles' music in sort of quite grandiose musical theory terms.
Yeah.
And the phrase is Aeolian cadences. Aeolian cadences. And John talks about this, and he says, in this film and in this interview, he says, you know, I don't even know what Aeolian cadences are. Mm. I think he makes a joke that he thought they were birds or something, right?
Yeah.
And it's not John. Like, the writer did actually attribute this as being something that the Beatles achieved through their music as a way of elevating what it is they do over other pop groups at the time.
Yeah.
But it always gets my back up a bit, because I'm not an expert in musical theory, but I know enough to know that Aeolian cadences aren't a thing.
Oh, okay. Right.
That's not a way to describe any kind of thing that music is doing anytime.
Okay.
So Aeolian is a term used to describe a particular mode of scale.
Okay.
So you have different types of scale. You have like Phrygian and Lydian and Mixolydian and Aeolian.
Sure.
Right. And a cadence is, you have different types of cadences which describe how a musical phrase concludes.
Right.
So you can have perfect cadences or imperfect cadences depending on whether a musical phrase comes to an ending that feels natural and resolves itself, or an imperfect one that feels like it ends on sort of, you know, in an unusual way that sort of adds like tension or something.
Okay, right? I can think of examples from Beatles songs of those things.
Yes, completely. Yeah. But you can't have an Aeolian cadence,
right?
A cadence isn't defined by the scale.
Yeah.
So you can't call out an Aeolian cadence, because that's not how it works. It's, you know, a cadence is, you know, in the key that it's in, it might end in a certain way, and that will define what kind of cadence it is.
Yeah.
Aeolian just means this is the kind of musical notes and harmonies that are being used in this song that belong to a particular mode of that scale.
Right, okay.
But they are separate things.
Right.
I'm literally just making a point to you, because bugs me every time I hear that phrase. So when John says, like, you know, I didn't even know Aeolian cadences were a thing, they're not. Basically, is my point.
Yeah, I think actually it's interesting, because I have read that review that William Mann did. I think it's called William Mann. So he was the sort of Times music critic, and so the Times would not have had a pop music critic at all.
Mm.
Like, his job was to review classical music at concerts and records, I presume. But so him writing about the Beatles at all was completely out of this world.
Yeah.
And to the fact that he had written about them in a serious way of appreciating what they had done. I seem to remember that the Aeolian cadence thing that he is talking about, he thinks incorrectly, as it turns out, is an Aeolian cadence, is the final chord of She Loves You, where it sort of ends on that, I think it's an extra sixth with the, which whatever it is.
I thought it was a different song, if I'm being completely honest, but I could be wrong.
And there is also something, maybe it's that, but he's also talking about a relatively obscure one.
Yeah.
On a Hard Day's Night. Something like I'll Be Back.
That's the one I'm thinking of. Something I can't remember what the song is, but it's a relatively obscure song.
Something along those lines.
I appreciate that just the fact of having this writer write about the Beatles in that way was hugely important at the time in terms of what it did for the status of the Beatles being thought of as a more intellectual group than your average pop band.
Yeah.
But as I understand it, or at least from my own learnings and teachings of around musical theory, he's wrong. I'm just saying that. I would even go so far as to say, I'll look it up and be quite happily be corrected. But my understanding of both of those phrases when it comes to musical theory is that they're not defined by each other, so it doesn't work for me.
Fair enough.
Just saying it. I can't think of any other opportunity on any other episode of this podcast where I would be able to make that point. So as soon as it came up as an interview, I was like, I'm now going to be able to express my frustration at that.
I think that's fair.
And what else is this podcast for if it's not for me to vent my own personal demons?
Exactly. Why bother having a podcast? I do think it's interesting that John remembers the phrase. I mean, given that, as we've said, he perhaps affects not to remember the order in which the albums came out.
Yeah,
he can very clearly remember a phrase used in a review of him from 1963 or whatever it was.
But it makes the same point there, doesn't it? Like this idea of him being removed or in some way apart from the sort of genius-like quality that's applied to him. So like this idea of, apparently it's an Aeolian cadence, but I just, knocked that off in my sleep, because I don't even know it was called that, right? Is kind of on the same kind of level as, which album came out first again? Was it Rubber Soul or was it Revolver? I didn't really pay attention to any of that stuff.
He's
kind of putting himself on a sort of different level away from the detail of the thing because it makes him seem like he's above it all.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, like one of the contradictions just within that interview is that he is sort of trying to express how he's a genius and says it. By the way, like he's asked, Jan Wenner asks him, are you a genius? And he immediately says, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, but if there is such a thing, then I am a genius or words to that effect.
Do you think you're a genius?
Yes. If there's such a thing as one, I am one,
He wants to express that, but and yet he just keeps on demystifying everything. He's constantly saying things like, because I think he's asked, why was the album called Rubber Soul? And he said, it's just sort of a pun, There's no great mystery to lots of this stuff, It's just stuff that happens, And like he's asked about the litany at the end of God, I don't believe in this, I don't believe in that. And first, asks for the word litany to be clarified, which is fair enough because you would not necessarily get it from what it was said. But and then he says, like everything else, they were just words that came out of my mouth.
Yeah,
and it's like, but I mean, this is like you singing those words and ending in "I don't believe in Beatles" is so significant. You can't get away from the significance of that, and you want the significance of your words to be sort of held true. It's obviously important to you, and yet you keep on at times just saying, none of it, we were just making it up as we went along, that kind of thing. He's very he's just very, very conflicted in general.
I think this is, this goes back to the point we made at the start of this, which was that are you a genius? Yes. Is kind of like a flippant answer for him to give. And he knows, it comes across as flippant.
Yeah, well, yes, but the tone in which he says it, both in the film and in the original, is absolutely serious.
He's saying yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I guess he knows that there's not a simple answer to that question.
Right.
So I get, by saying yes, there's a certain flippancy to that because,
Yeah, okay.
But his problem is that my reading of it is that immediately what comes to mind when being asked that question is, well, define genius. And he kind of asks that, doesn't he? He says, if there is such a thing, then yes, I am one.
Yeah.
But the reason why he ends up going around in circles and contradicting himself and, demystifying the work that goes into his genius is because he's still thinking about things in a sort of that holistic way. Like what is a genius? Like I am just saying these things. These words are just coming out of my mouth. Maybe that is genius, but who knows? Everyone calls me genius. So yes, I am. Like there's no decisive opinion about that, which is, I think is why he just keeps sort of bouncing around the topic rather than sort of being really, really clear on a particular subject.
Yeah, it does seem like it, doesn't it?
Which brings me to, and I feel like I've given away my answer for this, but it brings me to the last question I was going to ask you, which was, why do you think the film's called Rubber Soul?
Well, that's all we've got time for, folks. I don't know. I was thinking about this. It's funny, you know, when I was thinking with the title of David Sheff's book, All We Are Saying, people do tend to name things after individual song lyrics, biographies in particular. You know, there's a book about John's murder called Let Me Take You Down, for example. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, where someone's just taken like one phrase from the middle of a thing and put it in. And so Rubber Soul is not, obviously, is an album title and is never actually, there isn't a song called that. It's not in the lyrics anywhere or anything like that. So for me, it really stands out as quite a specific thing to call a film that is not about the period in which that album was made or anything like that. However, Rubber Soul is discussed in the Rolling Stone interview. Jan Wenner kind of puts forward the idea that Rubber Soul is when things started to change and when things kind of got serious, if you like. And actually, the framing of the Beatles' career into early Beatles and late Beatles, which is like a simplistic reading of it, but a popular one. And, you know, I'm as guilty of thinking of them in that way as anyone is. It makes sense, you know. Rubber Soul is kind of often thought of as the turning point. And so I suppose it has a significance in that regard, particularly because the Rubber Soul interview is kind of one of the main things that kicks off this idea that the Beatles, and Lennon in particular, were serious musicians to be taken seriously. You know, this was not music for teenage girls, and in fact, teenage girls should not have enjoyed it because they were getting it wrong.
Yeah.
That's key. and actually, this is music for serious people who think seriously about music and meaning and authenticity and things like that. So I think that's sort of the best reading I could get for why it's called that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a parallel to be drawn there. I was thinking about this, and, you know, like I guess I've already alluded to, I was going down a bit more of a metaphorical route and kind of imagined the Rubber Soul being John himself, and the rubber being him literally sort of bouncing around between different opinions on the same topic, and the idea of rubber itself being quite malleable and flexible, and sort of highlights how he can be quite, you know, flexible when talking about different things, and the conflicts and contradiction in the answers he gives. But who knows? Honestly, I think we're gonna have to try to get filmmaker John Lefkowitz in, you know, get in touch with him, and I'll put the question to him directly.
Yeah, why not?
Well, ultimately, what this all should be leading to is us trying to get the interview time with John Lefkowitz, and then we will post an episode in which we will ask his opinion about a Greg sausage roll, because as is how all interviews are happening now. So yeah, I think we have covered everything there is to cover on the film Rubber Soul. Again, available to watch for free currently at time of recording on YouTube, if you type in search for it. But we would love to know what you think. Please do go ahead and watch the film and get in touch with us and let us know whether you agree. Which of us do you think has the better interpretation of the film's title? Was our cadence aeolian enough for you? Let us know by getting in touch with us on all the usual social media platforms. We are at Beatles Films Pod. You can also leave us a review or a 5-star rating on your podcast listening platform of choice. In the meantime, we will see you again next week for another episode. And until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.